You guys arrested a Milwaukee County circuit judge for allegedly helping illegal immigrants get away. As you guys look at other judges, would you ever arrest somebody higher up on the judicial food chain, like a federal judge or even a Supreme Court justice?
Well, that's a hypothetical question. Again, I defer you to the Department of Justice for individuals that they are looking at or individual cases, but let's be clear about what this judge did. She obstructed federal law enforcement who were looking for an illegal alien in her courthouse. She showed that illegal alien the door to evade law enforcement officials. That is a clear-cut case of obstruction. You don't have to be a lawyer to understand that. And so anyone who is breaking the law or obstructing federal law enforcement officials from doing their jobs is putting themselves at risk of being prosecuted, absolutely.
That was Caroline Leavitt, the young, beautiful press secretary of President Trump. I really like Carolyn. She's a dynamo. But the answer is yes. Will you arrest any other judges? Is there a limit? Would you go higher? Yes. If they break the law, if they are lawless, we will arrest them. Well, now that's happening. We've had two judges arrested. We have a kind of a follow-up today on Judge Hannah Dugan in Wisconsin, in Milwaukee, the judge that was arrested for, you know, sneaking an illegal immigrant criminal out, you know, her private door and into freedom. But the ICE agents did catch him, but that's she's under arrest, but there's an update. But we're going to talk of the general topic today of lawlessness. Lawlessness. We're seeing it across the country. We're seeing it among the judges, we're seeing it among attorneys, certainly. We're seeing it on college campuses. We're seeing it from regular citizens who are doing unlawful things in the streets. And so that's our topic. And today we're going to talk about that with Professor William Jacobson of Cornell University. It's a really fascinating discussion, and I think you're going to enjoy it. As Mother's Day approaches, I wanted to highlight an organization that cares deeply for mothers. You probably know what's coming. Well, who is it? It's Preborn. Preborn's network of clinics exists exclusively to offer love, life, and support to pregnant mothers who are feeling scared and alone and are being pressured to make the ultimate choice that will not only sacrifice the life of their preborn baby, but take a piece of their own heart. When a distressed mom comes to Preborn, she's welcomed with open arms and offered a free ultrasound to hear and see the precious life inside her. And the majority of time, she will choose life. This Mother's Day, you can help bring life to both a mother in need and an at-risk baby. One ultrasound is only $28, but you know that. Do you know that five ultrasounds are $140? You see the endless possibilities of how much you can give. It just depends on what resources you have. But if you would like to help Preborn, if you haven't given before, Mother's Day is a good time to think about that. Some of you will look at Mother's Day with sorrow because some of you have chosen to abort a baby. And I just can't imagine. It's got to be. Remember that God can forgive you of anything. God can heal your broken heart. But as you think about this, it'd be probably a good idea to help Preborn so that they can stop this from happening to other women who make bad choices when sometimes they're young. If you would like to help Preborn, go to preborn.com/Sandy. That's preborn.com/Sandy. Well, you can call us at 662-821-2040. You can write us at sandy@afr.net. You can listen to us on any podcast platform. Our home base is afr.net. That's AmericanFamilyRadio.net. But all other podcast platforms, Spotify, Apple, whatever you like, Amazon, whatever you listen through, we are there. You can find us on social media, all the platforms. You can follow me on X and my Twitter handle. Isn't that lovely? I remember when they used to start saying that. I thought it was so funny. I could hardly bring myself to saying it. And now I'm saying it. It's at Sandy Rios Tweet. That's at Sandy Rios Tweet. Well, this is a chock full discussion of lawlessness around the country. And Professor William Jacobson is really an expert on this. He runs an organization called Legal Insurrection, Legal Insurrection. And he joins me on today's edition of Sandy Rios 24/7.
From American Family Radio, Sandy Rios.
We are not called to be nice. We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
I think the most important thing we need to demonstrate to our children is genuineness. That we actually believe what we say we believe.
A longtime Fox News contributor, Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
Seek justice. not social justice, but God's justice, what's right and what's wrong.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association,
a pro-life radio talk show host.
We've got to say this is the line. Life is sacred.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
Yesterday, California District Judge Jennifer Thurston demanded CBP agents cannot arrest suspected illegal migrants without a warrant or reason to believe the person is a flight risk before they can get one.
Also in the courtroom out of Wisconsin, the state Supreme Court temporarily suspending a judge charged with obstruction of justice. Hannah Dugan is the judge arrested after allegedly helping an illegal immigrant evade arrest.
All right, so today we're going to be talking about lawlessness. Professor Jacobson, who is my guest today, William Jacobson, has an entity called Legal Insurrection. And so I think our general theme is going to be the insurrection among the citizens, among the judges, among attorneys. It's just a free-for-all, really, in our legal system right now, and no one understands that better than Professor William Jacobson. He's the founder of Legal Insurrection. He also is the founder of the Equal Protection Project. We'll be talking about that. And he's a clinical law professor at Cornell University. Good morning, Professor Jacobson. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
I want to know, how do you get away with what you write and say and still be are employed at Cornell? I know I've asked you that before, but I'm just curious. I can't remember how that happens.
Yeah, well, first of all, I wouldn't have been hired 17 years ago had I had my website and my blog and had I been outspoken. And that's just the reality. I started everything a year after I joined there. So how do I survive? I don't know. I mean, there have been attempts over the years to get me fired, some frivolous, some more serious, more organized. But I've survived, and in part, it's because I have a high profile, I think. I come on shows like yours, and people know me, and so I think it makes it harder. I think there's a part of the school that actually likes having me there because I've been told it's used as a convenient deflection when the alums complain that there are no liberal professors. They say, there are no conservative professors. They say, we have Professor Jacobson. So they kind of use me to deflect criticism. So I think that's part of it. And I do think part of it is Cornell, I think, has a legitimate commitment to academic freedom of faculty. And so I think that's part of it also. So I think it's a combination of factors that I've been a survivor there.
Yeah, no, that's great. I'm glad to hear that. I'm from Chicago, and University of Chicago was famous for really being academically independent and wanting, you know, people from both sides and, you know, really rigorous teaching. But I don't know much about Cornell, and so I'm glad I know something about it, but like compared to Yale and Harvard, Princeton, would you say then, because they've been in the news for all the things, there's such a big bucket here, the protests against in favor of Hamas and all of the uprisings, the DEI and all of that, would you say that Cornell is a step back from the aggressiveness of those universities on those issues?
Yes, and I've said for many years, going back, you know, a decade, that while Cornell is left-leaning, while it is liberal, while the faculty is uniformly, with the exception of me, liberal, it is not Columbia, okay? And it is not Harvard or Yale. It is somewhat more moderate. Compared to where the U.S. population is, it's far left. But compared to where, you know, comparative schools are, it's moderate. So the best thing I can say about Cornell is it's not Columbia.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I get that. I get that. All right. One of the things, of course, that's been in the news is all these rogue judges. But to narrow even that, I'm interested today in talking to you about the judges that are actually rebelling on arrests of illegal immigrants. And, of course, we just heard that short report from Fox. There's another one in California now. But there's an update on Judge Hannah Dugan. Judge Dugan, I should call her, has been arrested because in her courtroom, an illegal immigrant was coming in for trial for his alleged illegal crimes, crimes are illegal, I guess, crimes. And she ushered him and his attorney through her door, the door that she uses in the courtroom, and to the outside, let him go. So that ICE agents who were there, and she knew they were there, who were going to arrest him, she had been warned and informed. She let them go, and that's why she's been arrested. So here, with that, let me play this update, and then I'm dying to know what your thoughts are about this. This is clip 5.
Yeah, well, Bill, the timing of this move to relieve Milwaukee County Circuit Judge Hannah Dugan of her duties is notable, given that it took the state Supreme Court more than 4 days to make this decision. Also given that the judge is facing federal charges for obstruction, which is a felony. And while she is presumed innocent until proven guilty, under Wisconsin state law, you legally can't hold public office if you've been convicted of a felony. It is also notable that the high court did not include in its order that Judge Dugan's salary be withheld while she is on administrative leave, meaning she will continue to receive her $174,000 salary while her own court case plays out. Despite that, her legal team released a statement saying, "We are disappointed that the court acted in unilateral fashion. We continue to assert Judge Dugan's innocence and look forward to her vindication in court." The chief judge of Milwaukee Circuit Court says other judges are shaken by the manner in which Dugan was arrested at the courthouse in her robes, and says he's working on a new policy laying out when and where federal agents can make arrests.
In a perfect world, we would have the opportunity to have a courthouse where people would never have to worry about coming there for their activities. But the reality is there are legal parameters which allow the government to effectuate warrants, and we're not going to interfere with that.
It also appears Judge Dugan is gearing up to vigorously fight the charges against her with an all-star legal team. Our Milwaukee Fox affiliate reports former U.S. Solicitor General Paul Clement has joined Dugan's defense team. Clement, who served under former President George W. Bush, was described as a LeBron James of lawyers by Bloomberg Law and has argued more than 100 cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. A grand jury will now hear Judge Dugan's case and decide if this is going to move on to trial.
All right. Well, you know, there's so many things, right, Bill? Okay, so let's start with this. What is the law regarding a judge who becomes lawless? I mean, has she broken the law? Was that a legitimate arrest?
Well, the status of judges under the law is the same as any other citizen. You know, judge can't hold up a liquor store and say, "Hey, I'm a judge, you can't arrest me." Judge cannot interfere with immigration enforcement by seeking, arguably, that's the claim, to assist someone in escaping, and then say, "Hey, I'm a judge, you can't stop me." I think this would be very different if she issued a ruling from the bench as part of her judicial duties. So if there was a case before her and she made a ruling and you appeal it. But that's not what is alleged to have happened here. What is alleged to have happened here is that she escorted, as you mentioned, or the clip mentioned, escorted this person through a private exit and stalled, you know, ICE, and allegedly was trying to facilitate his escape and interfere with immigration enforcement, lawful immigration enforcement. So I don't think a judge in that circumstance has any legal rights that you or I don't have. If you interfere with law enforcement, that is a crime, you know, when they're in the process of, you know, effectuating an arrest. So I don't think she has any special status just because she's a judge. I think there could be areas where she would have protection. Again, if she issued a judicial ruling as to something, you appeal it. But this was not a judicial ruling. This is sneak them out the back door.
Yeah, it was. Just really disgusting. And we're centering in on her. There, the New Mexico case is shocking to me too. This judge who's hiding this violent illegal immigrant. In fact, he had a phone of that guy he was harboring. Had the guy's phone, and it had photos of two people who had been beheaded, and this judge is hiding him. So, and he's been arrested. So it's really actually very serious. But on the case of Hannah Dugan, she got 4 days. No, that can't be right. They waited 4 days to. She stayed in. I guess I don't know where she stayed. She must be in jail. But it took four days for the Supreme Court in Wisconsin to put her on administrative leave. I don't know. Is that something to talk about? What do you think the proper procedure should be in terms of the court disciplining her? How does this work? Does the law system, the prosecutors, have precedence over the Supreme Court in Wisconsin in terms of how to handle this?
Well, I think that where you have criminal charges filed, putting someone on administrative leave, paid administrative leave, probably is the appropriate short-term remedy. Now, if she gets convicted, that's a different story. But she hasn't been convicted. She's just been charged. So I think that that probably is right. Whether 4 days, I'd like to know what happened in those 4 days. Was she still on the bench? Was she still ruling? Or was it 4 days when nothing was really happening anyway? 4 days doesn't strike me as in and of itself inappropriate. But if she was continuing to conduct trials, continuing to make rulings, that would be concerning. So I'd need to know a little bit more about what she was doing in those 4 days. But, you know, putting her on administrative leave seems like the right remedy in this situation. And if she's convicted, then that's a different story.
Yeah. The really surprising part, and I understand, I've been married to two attorneys, professors, so I know a little bit about the law, not much. But I do know that this next part really disturbed me. And I know that everybody deserves good defense. I get that. That's the part I was getting to. A public defender, everyone has a right to defense in this country. And I understand that. I had a good friend who defended a murderer years ago, and the people in our circles, because he was a good friend, were so upset with him. But, you know, he provided a good defense for this guy. Somebody had to do that. So that brings me to the second part of that report where Paul Clement, now former U.S. Solicitor General, and I bet you know, you might know him personally. I know of him. I was in D.C. when he was there. He was really a legend. Now he's stepping in to defend this judge. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, yeah, Paul Clement, I don't know him personally. I know of him, you know, really a giant in conservative legal circles. And, you know, whether you agree with her defense or you don't, you know, we uphold the principle that even accused murderers, even the worst among us, get to have their day in court and get to have a proper defense. And so it doesn't trouble me that he's doing that. I don't, you know, hold it against him or anything like that. And you know what? Let her get the best legal help she can. And that way, when she's convicted, or if she's convicted, nobody can say she didn't, you know, get a fair shot.
Okay, I can go with that. I can go with that opinion. Professor, before we leave the whole issue of rogue judges, there have been so many in all of these lower court decisions. I just don't want to leave that topic until you've had a chance to just express your opinion about just the whole general mood of judges really, I think, rebelling against the law and stepping out of their lane. Do you see this? I see this as a total breakdown, a threatened total breakdown of our legal system. I'd like to know how you see it.
Yeah, I've written a lot about the judges who've been ruling and issuing temporary restraining orders about the Trump administration. I do think it's extremely troubling. I think that a lot of them have stepped out of the separation of powers boundaries. They don't get to run the executive department, the executive branch, just like the executive branch doesn't get to run the judicial branch. And a lot of what they've been doing is not really judicial review. It's judicial micromanagement. Who can you hire? Who can't you hire? What can you spend? What are you allowed to look at? I mean, really, I think in a grotesque sort of way, in many cases, overstepping the boundaries that judges are supposed to have in the federal system. So I agree with that. I think the Supreme Court has been lax in addressing this problem. It's finally addressing it in a few cases. But I argued in early February when this all started that if they don't step in and shut this down with stays, that's how you shut it down, you essentially put a hold on these crazy orders, that things are going to get out of control. And I think things are out of control. There was a very organized effort. Even the New York Times reported on it last November that the Democrats, after the election, organized over 800 attorneys to prepare to challenge every single thing the Trump administration does. And that's what's happened. We have over 200 lawsuits around the country. many of them supposedly emergencies, filed on a Friday night, screaming, if you don't issue an injunction right away, the world is going to end. And unfortunately, there are many, not all, but many federal judges who have gone along with that. And it really damages trust in the judiciary because they are seen, I think, properly so in many cases, as being participants in this, not neutral observers who are ruling on the legality of it. And so that's really unfortunate. And the Democrats, with this tactic, which unfortunately some judges have bought into, I think have done tremendous damage. And that's why I think you hear words like, judicial insurrection being thrown around.
Yeah. Well, I that's how I see it, too. One of the most disturbing things about this whole process, this most current process of this, is the conduct of Chief Justice Roberts. Judge Boasberg was the first one to throw down the gauntlet to obstruct President Trump's orders. And, he is the D.C., as you know, he's a D.C. Circuit judge. But what we do know also now, first of all, let me just say that Judge Roberts is so reticent to do hardly anything. That's been his kind of history from my perspective. He doesn't want to make a real decision, not a full decision. It's always a half measure. He doesn't want to get involved. He didn't want to get involved in the 2020 election stuff. The Supreme Court sort of was feckless, and he was the leader of that. So now Judge Boasberg issues this order, lawless order, really. He doesn't have a right to do it, to stop President Trump from exporting these illegal immigrants to El Salvador. And guess what? Justice Roberts, like 30 seconds later, issues this opinion that I forget exactly now because it seems like so much news and I can't remember. But he stepped in and made a statement kind of defending Judge Boasberg. And then we find out that Justice Roberts and Boasberg are very good friends. Their families do things together. We find out that Judge Roberts nominated or put Judge Boasberg on the infamous, and I say infamous now, FISA court. I just feel that is really unseemly. I don't know if you see it that way, but that makes me really, that makes me feel creepy about our justice, Chief Justice.
Well, I think there's a public perception that is perhaps more concerned than they should be. I'm not worried about Chief Justice Roberts knowing a particular district court judge. The reality is they all run in the same circles. Okay, that's a bigger problem, but I don't think it's specific here. I think the bigger problem with Roberts is he's very afraid of the media, and he's very afraid of negative publicity, but only when it comes in one direction. You'll remember
exactly.
Back in 2012, the Obama administration, and Obama was upfront about it, okay, said they're going to pressure the Supreme Court on Obamacare ruling that was coming up. I remember that. And the Democrats launched a campaign to tell Chief Justice Roberts, if you strike down Obamacare, your court's going to lose all its legitimacy, et cetera, et cetera. And there are reports, which I think are credible. There were reports from, mainstream media who claimed to have sources that Roberts switched his vote, that he was going to vote with the other conservatives to strike down Obamacare. And instead, he came up with a novel theory that nobody expected, that Obamacare was not actually Obamacare. It was just a form of tax. And of course, the government has the ability to tax and rescued it on that basis. And that has been his MO, that he succumbs to pressure from the left. But when the right, through right-wing media, puts pressure, all of a sudden he issues a public statement, telling them to cut it out. But doesn't do that. Remember the hype around Justice Kavanaugh's nomination?
Yes, I do.
And, they so inflamed things that some lunatic showed up at his door with a gun. And fortunately, the U.S. Marshals were there to prevent an assassination. But that's how they inspired. I don't remember Roberts making statements about that. Chuck Schumer on the steps of the Supreme Court about how, you'll catch the whirlwind, et cetera.
You'll reap the whirlwind, yes.
You'll reap the whirlwind.
Yeah. Yes, and he stood on the steps and said that. Yeah. So, your point is then that Roberts didn't respond to that. He wasn't intimidated by conservatives.
He only responds when people are criticizing the judge who issued the crazy injunction. That all of a sudden now he needs to speak up, but doesn't speak up when it comes in the other direction.
Well, exactly.
That's the problem. That's the view of him, is that he's become a creature of D.C. I say become. Maybe he's always been a creature of D.C. and is very concerned about the D.C. orbit and, you know, how he's viewed in that orbit.
Yeah. Well, all I could say, professors, I hope it's that innocent. I guess I'm still more of a skeptic. I have a darker view of it, but there's no need to belabor it. I just am very concerned about him for a number of reasons. But there's lawlessness everywhere right now, and I now want to talk about the lawlessness of the citizens. We're going to get to college campuses in just a second, but this was in your publication just this morning, Legal Insurrection. By the way, I highly recommend. They cover a lot of different topics, but Legal Insurrection, is it .org or .com? How could they find you?
So we have multiple websites. Our main website, the main politics and law website that most people know us through, is legalinsurrection.com. But we have two other websites, projects, one of which is criticalrace.org, where we have tracked and documented through interactive maps at over 700 colleges and universities the spread of critical race theory in its various forms, really unique maps that nobody else has. And equalprotect.org, which is the Equal Protection Project, that's equalprotect.org, is something we launched 2 years ago, and we've brought almost 100 legal challenges to discriminatory DEI programs at colleges and universities. So there's many ways to find me. People can also Google my name, and you'll find more than you want to know.
Yeah, and you're on Twitter under your own name, not your entities, and it's at W.A. Jacobson, W.A. Jacobson. All right, so then we have this thing down in Charlottesville, University of Virginia campus. Well, not the campus, but in a courtroom. And you've got ICE agents who are trying to arrest an illegal immigrant who's charged with a number of things. And they have, as I read in your publication this morning, the ICE agents presented the information to the justice. I think they were going to judge. They were going to arrest, I think, two different criminals. And so they are standing at the back, I think, outside the courtroom. And this is what transpires. Let's listen. This is clip 3.
Excuse me, you cannot impede me on my lawful duties. That is a crime. Do you understand? Do not touch me or impede me in my lawful duties, ma'am. Do you understand? It is a crime for you to do so.
Why? Do you have a warrant for his arrest? Do you have a warrant for his arrest?
Yes.
Where?
Hey, grab him.
Get
off me, or I am calling the U.S. attorney and prosecuting you for assault on a federal officer.
Show us the warrant.
Back up.
Show us a warrant signed by a judge.
Turn him around.
You don't have a warrant.
Sure.
Show us a warrant for his arrest.
We are officers with Homeland Security.
You don't have a warrant signed by a judge.
All right, and then it goes further in there. I think some of the professors got involved, and these are two people, masked women. I think they're masked. Yes. Who are actually trying to stop these agents from arresting this illegal immigrant. Okay. So, Professor Jacobson, what is the law here? This is a courtroom. The ICE officials have told the judge what they're doing, given the names. They are following procedure, it sounds like. And then they get, I don't know if you called it an assault, but a near assault by these two people trying to prevent them from arresting this illegal immigrant. What is the law there? Do they need a warrant for an illegal immigrant?
Well, I think I'm not sure about that. It might depend on the circumstances. But as a general matter, they don't need a criminal arrest warrant. They simply need to follow whatever procedure the immigration laws require them to follow. So I'm not sure if they need a quote-unquote warrant to arrest him, but that's somewhat irrelevant. You don't have a right to interfere in the police making arrest. As a citizen, you don't get the right to demand that the police show you a warrant to arrest some other person. okay? You can ask for it, and they can tell you no, like they did in that clip, but you don't have a right to interfere. You don't have to, and I don't think you need to assault the officers in order for you to unlawfully interfere in that immigration enforcement. So I think we're coming to a head in this country. I think we're going to see mayors arrested because there is the whole sanctuary city, sanctuary campus, sanctuary courtroom movement that, you know, has been around for a decade, but we've never really had a president. And Trump in his first term didn't really challenge that. We've never had a president who has challenged that. You don't have a right as a city to declare that ICE is not allowed to come in and arrest people. You may not have an obligation to help them. You could sit on your hands. You could do nothing. But you don't have a right to actively interfere in their actions. That's, you know, federal supremacy clause. You know, the immigration laws are the law of the land. And they're law of the land in Madison, Wisconsin. And they're the law of the land in all of these jurisdictions. And you don't have a right to unilaterally interfere with that. And I think we're going to get to that. I think, you know, now that they've arrested a judge for allegedly interfering in an unlawful manner, not through a judicial ruling, but through sneaking somebody out the back door, I think you're going to see mayors. I think you're going to see police chiefs. I mean, you know, we see it all the time in Ithaca, where Cornell is located. They are actively against ICE, but I don't know yet that they've actually unlawfully interfered, but it's going to happen. And I think you're going to see more and more of this as immigration enforcement, you know, ramps up.
Well, it's all very interesting. And of course, when we think of lawlessness, one of the things that one of the entities that's making headlines continuously is college campuses. And you're certainly an expert on that. And I want to bring this, again, was also a story on today's edition of the Legal Insurrection, and you can sign up for that at legalinsurrection.org. But it's happening
.com,
in law.
.com. Legalinsurrection.com.
Okay, I'm going to make that same mistake again if I don't find my .com. Okay. All right. This at UCLA, and here's the background on this. This was last spring. There were student-led protests, you know, defending Hamas. They created Jew-free zones. A rabbi was assaulted. Jewish students were prevented from moving across the campus. And so here we are a year. In fact, this clip I want to play for people to hear, which is also on your in your article, is kind of an idea of what happened in that situation. This is clip two. Let's listen.
Expecting that line of delineation halfway through the quad. Look at this. Somebody is being beaten. Somebody is being beaten with a stick and punches in the middle of the lawn. Somebody is being badly beaten at the bottom of that brawl right there. Look at that. Look at that. Somebody is being dragged and beaten in the front of that plywood wall. Just incredible.
Like,
where are the police? Where is security? Where are these people? Where is authority here? It is something I have never covered without any sign of enforcement, law enforcement, security whatsoever. This has gone now on for over an hour and a half, and it is absolutely appalling, in my estimation, that we have not seen any response. I've just never seen it. You know, this may be a sign of things to come, or this may be what, you know, society has become, but I have never seen it. In my career, I have never seen this level of violence without any response from any kind of law enforcement or authority whatsoever.
Well, I hate to say it, but the last time I saw anything like this was Florence and Normandy in 1992.
All right. The Los Angeles Times actually described that uprising, I would call it that, as a how events exploded into savagery and chaos. And the Los Angeles Times is not a conservative paper, I might add. So now what's happened? The issue here is that two people, it's been a year now, and two people have been charged. And guess who they were? They were Eden Ahn and Matthew Katz, both Jewish students who tried ISO. I don't know what they actually did, but obviously they were trying to defend the Jewish side of this. And the other protesters, none of them were arrested. So your thoughts about this, Professor Jacobson, what's going on? This is a one situation in UCLA. Maybe you could make a comment about that. But the broader issue, of course, is this is happening on college campuses everywhere, and no one seems to be reining it in.
This is a problem that's much more widespread than the campuses. You know, we've seen a lack of law enforcement against crimes in almost every Democrat-run city where there's a Democrat-elected prosecutor, district attorney, and selective enforcement. And this is the whole issue of the so-called Soros prosecutors, where George Soros very publicly, you know, people say, oh, you're conspiracy theories. No, it was public, you know, reported on in Politico and elsewhere that Soros, I forget what year it was, maybe it was 2020, maybe it was 2022, you know, put big money into electing left-wing prosecutors who wouldn't prosecute. And that's what we've seen everywhere, and we're seeing it on the campuses too, that you have very aggressive criminal behavior by anti-Israel protesters. And I always want to emphasize to people, the anti-Israel protesters are also anti-American protesters. When they burn Israeli flags, they also burn American flags. The goal, we've heard so much about this guy, Mahmoud Khalil from Colombia, who's they're trying to deport. I mean, the group he ran, stated goal was the destruction of Western civilization. So these people are not just anti-Jewish, they're anti-Christian, they're anti-American, they're anti-Western, okay? And I think we need to make that clear. The problem that we're seeing on the campuses about the anti-Semitism is a symptom of a much deeper problem on the campuses where we have faculty and administrators who are indoctrinating students to hate our country, to hate Christianity, to hate Judaism, to hate anything affiliated with Western society. And so that's a deeper problem, and I want to make that clear. This is not about the Jews, okay? It's about all of us, and we need to understand what's going on. With that said, we have a problem where crimes are not being prosecuted. We have, you know, in New York City, you can do almost anything and not get prosecuted. Unless, of course, you're Donald Trump, in which case they revive a stale, out-of-time bookkeeping offense to try to prosecute you, Alvin Bragg, the Manhattan District Attorney. Yeah. And we're seeing it on the campuses, that the anti-Israel students do not want to abide by the rules that everybody else has to abide by. And when you do enforce it and you do treat them equally, they scream that they're victims. They scream that they're being, you know, selectively prosecuted. And so the UCLA incident, I don't know if these two people who have been charged did a crime or not. It's kind of irrelevant. They've been charged. But what about all the others? What about the 100 anti-Israel students who were engaged in criminal activity? Why aren't they being prosecuted as well? And that's the issue, is that we have a complete breakdown in the prosecutorial system in Democrat-run jurisdictions where if you are of the left, you are very unlikely to get prosecuted for beating up, you know, pro-Israel students, erecting encampments and creating so-called Zionist free zones, obstructing people, unlawfully imprisoning people on bridges. And some people have been charged in that. Let's see if they follow through with the prosecution, where you block a bridge and you effectively trap people. You know, that's unlawful imprisonment. And they do that all the time, and it's rarely prosecuted. And so it's a more systemic problem that we have. It's a deliberate, total breakdown of law enforcement, which the Trump administration is trying to reverse. And they're screaming bloody murder that they're trying to actually enforce the laws against these hoodlums.
And very well said, Professor. And I think the whole point that this is not like even simplified as anti-Trumpers, which is, I think, some people who are not very well informed think it's all about that. It isn't. They are anti-American. They hate this country. And I think, you know, it's interesting when you see kind of the core of this kind of movement, you see these, sorry, I'm going to make a derogatory statement about old white activists, old white hippies, who, you know, with the long hair and white hair are, you know, in the middle of so much of this. And then, of course, I think we have a lot of jihadis. Palestinian people who've been are Palestinian sympathizers of the Hamas style Palestinians who have infiltrated, who have been freely brought into this country, and we're dealing with all of that too. And I think a lot of it also is then just students and people who are just ignorant. They don't know the whole they don't have a full understanding, as most of us don't, but we have a better understanding about the conflict in the Middle East, and so they just join in. So we got a mess, and we're trying to change it. And thank God President Trump is trying to do that. Now I want to have one last thing I want to talk to you about, because this is Riley, really in your bailiwick. All of this is, but I want to start this discussion by playing a statement. This is a Reuters presentation. President Trump's statement on DEI when he first got in office, and this is clip six.
We will forge a society that is colorblind and merit-based.
U.S. President Donald Trump has put diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI, on the chopping block in the first 100 days.
Reforming the system of hiring.
A torrent of far-reaching executive orders and agency-level directives have dismantled or severely weakened regulatory safeguards to address structural inequality. Civil rights advocates have argued such programs are necessary to address longstanding inequities, but the Trump administration terms it woke ideology.
All right, so that's enough of that. But I think that's how they frame it, meaning the left, that's Reuters. And it's diversity, equity, and inclusion. It's everywhere. It's infected every area of our national life. So you have founded this Equal Protection Project. And explain to, first of all, what you're trying to do. And then let's talk about a case or so to give people an idea of, you mentioned it earlier, but let's put some flesh on it.
So Equal Protection Project, which is equalprotect.org, is a project we launched in February 2023 to challenge what we refer to as DEI discrimination. There are a shocking number of universities who have programs that exclude people based on race. And typically the person openly excluded based on race are white students. So you have so-called programs only for students of color. You have programs only for BIPOC. Your listeners may not know what that means, but that's
an acronym.
Black, Indigenous, people of color, okay? So you have a lot, I mean, it's crazy what has happened, but you have a lot of programs that are limited to that. Sometimes they'll be specific to black students, but more often it's students of color. We have challenged close to 100 colleges and universities for over 300 such programs. We've had about a 50% success rate so far. We haven't lost a case, but some are still working their way through the system. And what we see is just absolutely shocking. I could rattle off a bunch of examples. They're often combined with sex discrimination against men, almost exclusively men, occasionally women. There will be some scholarships just for men, but that's not the norm. Normally, it's, women in STEM, scholarships, things like that. And so we challenge mostly race and ethnic discrimination. And we will challenge, if we saw a program or scholarship that was open only to whites, we would challenge it in a heartbeat. This isn't a white versus black thing. It's that all of the programs we've seen so far discriminate against whites, sometimes against Asians, but never in favor of whites, and we'd be against that. We wouldn't support that. But what I'm saying is, people sometimes will say, well, why are you only challenging programs that help blacks? We're not. We're challenging discriminatory programs. No matter who they benefit or who they harm, we will challenge them. And please bring me a program that in its promotional materials says this is only open to whites. Nobody's been able to do that. But there are hundreds of programs that are only open to students of color or BIPOC.
Yeah, well, this
and we, I'm just, and that's what we do, and we do it every day. We rely a lot on tips from the public. At our website, we have a contact form, and many of our cases come through tips from students, professors, alumni, or just people in the community.
Well, and of course, this is all based on the 14th Amendment that we need to hasten to say, because there is equal protection under the law. And a lot of those, the move in the country to make things more equal, you could argue that that was necessary. Certainly, black people in our country were disadvantaged. I totally agree with that. I don't know if I agree with the way it was done, but now it's become baked in the cake. And now black Americans, which is actually, I'm happy and thrilled to say that they have moved up. They're getting great jobs. In fact, they're getting preference, I think, now. And that is the point. It's probably gone over the line, and now white Americans are being discriminated against. And we have a promise of equal protection under the law, and that's what your organization is trying to reinstate, the Equal Protection Project. Bill, do you think
right? Our philosophy is that the answer to racism is not more racism. Okay, we acknowledge what has happened in the past, and programs that might have been acceptable in the late 60s and 70s, soon after, you know, the Civil Rights Act was passed, so-called remedial programs. But those are legally acceptable. There's a carve-out that if an institution is trying to remedy its own history of discrimination, that's acceptable. But that's not what's going on. That's not what's been going on in the last 20 years. Maybe that's what was going on in the 60s and 70s, but it's not what's going on now. Now it's a broader ideology, often referred to as critical race theory or diversity, equity, inclusion, or, quote, anti-racism, close quote. And it's an ideological thing, and that injects more racism, more discrimination into the system in order to remedy some greater society good. And that's just not lawful. I don't think it's moral to do that. I don't think it's fair to punish some 18-year-old kid who's never done anything to anybody in his or her whole life, and you're going to hold them responsible for something that happened 100 years ago or 50 years ago just because they have the same skin color as the person who did that 50 years ago. How wrong is that? It's also unlawful. We have never challenged a program merely because it seeks to increase diversity. We only challenge programs that violate the civil rights laws or that violate the Constitution if they're a public entity. And so we seek out and challenge unlawful conduct. We do not seek out and challenge programs just because they're part of DEI or just because they seek diversity. We've never challenged something just for that reason.
Well, I just want to point out that we're in a tremendous struggle in this country. President Trump has done some amazing things, but he's one man. And I wanted you to meet Professor William Jacobson, who's fighting in this arena of college campuses, of diversity, equity, and inclusion, of lawlessness, all of that. That's what he writes about. It's legalinsurrection.com, criticalrace.org, if that's an area of interest to you, and also Equal Protect. That's the organization we're just speaking about, equalprotect.org. Professor Jacobson, it's always a pleasure. I really appreciate having time with you, and thank you for making us smarter today. Thank you.
Great. Thank you for having me on.
My pleasure. All right, Sandy Rios on Sandy Rios 24/7. Hi, this is Sandy Rios. A lot of Christians would be shocked to learn they are personally profiting from abortion and pornography. It's unnerving to realize just how many companies and corporations are actively involved in unbiblical practices. To help cut through the red tape, there is a great option known as Timothy Plan. Timothy Plan is the pioneer in biblically responsible investing. Timothy Plan carefully filters out companies involved in practices Scripture tells us to avoid. We are in an all-out culture war. One powerful way to make a difference is to put our money where our values are. Please go to timothyplan.com/Sandy. That's timothyplan.com/Sandy. Or call 1-800-TIM-PLAN. That's 1-800-846-7526. Discover how to be a biblically responsible investor.
Before investing, carefully consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the investment company. This and other important information can be found in the fund's prospectus. To obtain a copy, visit timothyplan.com or call 800-846-7526. Read each prospectus carefully before investing.
This is Sandy Rios 24/7 on American Family Radio.
Well, Mother's Day is a time of joy. It is for me. It was always bittersweet for me because my first child, a daughter, was severely disabled. So it was always bittersweet. And for some of you, it may be bittersweet as well because perhaps you've aborted a baby. Or, you know, you could be a dad or a mom and say that. And remember Mother's Day as the day you could have had another child, or a child for that matter, and that you actually made that decision. And this might bring up some bad memories. Now, I always want to hasten to remind you that there's nothing God can't forgive. And if you still have real strong feelings, I think it's some healthy guilt is good. But if you still have some really healthy feelings of condemnation and you've prayed about it, you know that God can forgive. A lot of that accusation is from Satan himself, that long, bony, pointed finger that accuses you. He is the accuser. So I'm not recommending that. But as we approach this day, there are things, you know, first of all, understand that if you have asked for forgiveness and you meant it and you had remorse, you have been forgiven. But the rest of you who are enjoying this Mother's Day and you haven't had that situation in your life by God's grace, it's a good time to remember, you know, how precious babies are. Oh my goodness, what I wouldn't give for another baby in my life, another grandchild, you know, I don't think I'll be having another baby. But it's just one of the greatest joys of life to have a little baby in your life. And so I want to say happy Mother's Day to all of you fellow mothers out there. And I encourage the rest of you. And that brings me to preborn, because they celebrate life every day by stopping women from making the terrible decision to take the life of their baby. I'm all about that, all about trying to prevent that, and so are they. And they do it by showing ultrasounds to women who are, you know, thinking about terminating their pregnancy. And it's very effective, because when they see the baby, they just realize, this is a really little person, and it's my baby. And I just can't do this. And so if you'd like to help in honor of this Mother's Day week, and maybe it's time to do something really special, and that's give to preborn. It's $28 for one ultrasound, and whatever multiple of that you can afford would be so greatly appreciated. Go to preborn.com/Sandy. That's preborn.com/Sandy.
The Sandy Rios 24/7 podcast are available at AFR.net. Back to Sandy Rios 24/7 on American Family Radio.
Academia has been in Trump's broader crosshairs. The administration wants to dismantle the Department of Education and revoke funding from schools teaching curricula that it deems discriminatory. Conservative groups have praised these actions and view them as essential for exposing what Trump and cabinet officials have called waste, fraud, and abuse. Historians and legal scholars have cited the Trump administration's attempts at censoring books and teachers that talk about the country's racist history as evidence of a broader move toward authoritarianism. Former employees argue that the downsizing of the Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights sends a troubling message about the government's dedication to safeguarding the rights of marginalized students.
All right. Well, that's Reuters again, and they have a definite opinion, which is not mine, probably not yours either. Diversity, equity, inclusion really does divide people into races. Identified by your race. I'm a white person. I'm a privileged person. I'm a black person, so I'm oppressed. This is all out of the Communist Handbook, by the way. Oppressor and oppressed. Oppressor and oppressed. They did it in China. They did it in Russia. The peasants versus the, you know, the, what was it? The business of the landowners. They always think of some victim and some oppressor. And of course, there's always some truth to it. That's why it has such power. But life is not all about that, and that is not always the dominating force. And sometimes it's happened in the past, and we have to get over it. And I think that's true in this country. We cannot live. And, you know, I talked about that a few minutes ago with the abortion thing, that Satan is the accuser. He loves to divide people and accuse them and make their, you know, divide and create problems. I mean, so Saul Alinsky, one of the leaders of the left many years ago, wrote this book called Rules for Radicals, which he dedicated to Lucifer, the Lucifer. And he said, the first great rebel. So you don't think for a minute that this is not tied to darker forces. DEI is tied to darker forces, and that's a communism, which I think springs from a godless, I don't think, I know, it springs from a godless philosophy. So why wouldn't Lucifer's way of doing things predominate or be the dominating force, which is destruction of relationships, destruction of communities? We have come a long way, and for those of you who are, what we just don't want anymore, let me just say this. I certainly recognize, in particular, Black Americans, the history, because I lived through a lot of that. My sister lived in Atlanta during the 60s. We used to go down and I saw white and colored fountains. I witnessed blacks in the back of the bus. It was horrific. The hoses turned on them. It was horrific. The hangings, that kind of preceded my time a little bit, but they were real. And then after that, the lack of opportunity, the tremendous prejudice that was built up because they had been dehumanized by people that enslaved them. So I understand all of that. But I think for any situation like that, you have to get past it. You can't live with that as your theme. You can't live and dwell and, you know, carry the resentment of your parents, your forefathers. Well, easy for me to say, you say. Okay, so let me give you a different example. You know, anytime you have been wronged, and there are other ways of being wronged besides being enslaved, there are terrible abuses in families. There are horrible divorces between spouses, mistreatment, abuse. I'm sure there are other things, murders. I mean, lots of things. The way, God's way is not to be defined by that. Do you not see people who have been abused or mistreated by others and they never get over it? They live in bitterness and resentment. They, even though the story may have happened, the situation may have happened, you know, decades before, that's where they live. They see everything in that light. They never get past it. It's the same principle on slavery and racism. It is the very same principle. God does not want us to dwell. It's not good for us. We look to the future. We look ahead. We don't look back. We have to forgive. The only way we can forgive is just to let go of it and be grateful. That doesn't mean you forget it. It still needs to be taught in our curriculums. I think the truth about our history should be right there, but it's a matter of scope and emphasis. Right now, the black activists, the Al Sharptons, the creepy guys like that, they are creepy. They want you to live there. They want to stir it up. Well, Barack Obama did too. So did Eric Holder. Let's stir it up. Let's make it worse. Let's just talk about it again and then create this whole notion of white privilege and just create resentment from whites to blacks. That's what we want. We want this resentment because then we can control their thinking and we can lead them in ways we couldn't if they didn't perceive this to be a problem. So it's insidious, and I just think that the whole issue of DEI needs to be a stake, needs to be put in its heart. And that's what William Jacobson and his organization, the Equal Protection Project, is trying to do. So I hope you enjoyed our discussion today. And I want to thank you for joining us. But I want to thank first our sponsor, Timothy Plan, because they show you how to put your money where your values are and discover how to be a biblically responsible investor. Visit timothyplan.com/Sandy. That's timothyplan.com/Sandy. Or call 1-800-TIM-PLAN. That's 1-800-TIM-PLAN. Well, thank you. Thank you for listening to today's edition of Sandy Rios 24/7.